आतिनचन्द्रतारकम् नीमा विद्युतो भान्ति कुतो यम अग्निः त्वमेव भान्तम् अनुभाति सर्वं तस्य भासा सर्वमिदं विभाति। ॐ देयर द सन शाइन्स नॉट नॉट द मून नॉट द स्टार्स नॉट द लाइटनिंग वेयर इज फायर दाउ शाइनिंग एवरी अदर ऑब्जेक्ट shines in this universe. It is thy light that illumines the hearts of the sages and devotees. Shine thou in our hearts, manifest therein all thy glory, and dispel all darkness and ignorance. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. Our subject this morning, the message of the Upanishads. The Upanishads form the latter portion of the Vedas. Now, what are the Vedas? As you know, every religion has some scriptures, the revealed scriptures. The Bible, the Quran, the Tripitaka, the Zendavesta. See, all these are the revealed scriptures of the many religions of the world. And the Vedas are considered the revealed scriptures of the Indo-Aryans. Now the Vedas again are divided into two portions called the work portion and the knowledge portion. The knowledge portion is what we call the Upanishads, the latter part of the Vedas. That is why again the Upanishads go by the name Vedanta. Veda, the Vedas, and Anta means the end or the latter portion of the Vedas. Now again, Vedanta also means the end of Veda or knowledge. Veda means knowledge. The end of wisdom, which means the supreme wisdom. Now what is the literal meaning of the word Upanishad? The derivative meaning of the word is to sit devotedly near. Also, it has the meaning secret knowledge. The third meaning, which has been given by the great commentator Shankara, is knowledge of Brahman, Brahma Vidya. Knowledge of Brahman that drives away our ignorance and bondage, and leads us to what is known as moksha or liberation. Now, I would give the meaning to the Upanishads by combining all these three different meanings. That is, it means the supreme knowledge of Brahman, which one can attain by sitting devotedly at the feet of a teacher who gives the secret knowledge It is known to be secret because only in silence this knowledge can be imparted to one whose heart is purified. So you see, you can combine all these three meanings to give the real spirit of the Upanishads. Now, of course, it is very difficult to tell you the date of the Upanishads. It can be anybody's guess, as you say in slang. We find the Western scholars want to find out some dates to everything. But the Indian scholars are not interested in those things. But anyway, we find that scholars have ascribed the date to the Upanishads from 3000 BC to 800 BC. Sometime during that period or extending between that period, these Upanishads were written. Their authorship practically is unknown. Of course, we get mention of certain names to whom the truth and particular truths were revealed. But their lives remain unknown. And these persons and personages claim no originality or authorship to these revelations that came through them. In fact, they declare that this was revealed to me. I did not originate this truth. This I received directly from God. As such, you see, these persons remain almost impersonal as the teachings of the Upanishads by themselves are impersonal. Now, I already, in defining the meaning of the term Upanishad, pointed out that it deals with the knowledge of Brahman. In the Upanishads again, which I shall quote to you, a distinction is made between what is known as the lower knowledge and what is known as the higher knowledge. Here we find in one of the Upanishads, the Mundakam. The lower knowledge, the lower is knowledge of the Vedas and also of phonetics, ceremonials, grammar, etymology, meter, and astronomy. See, within the lower knowledge also you mark how the knowledge of the Vedas, the knowledge of the scriptures is regarded. The knowledge of the scriptures also is regarded as lower knowledge. And any knowledge or empirical knowledge of this objective universe is a lower knowledge. Whatever we experience through the doors of the senses or with the help of our mind and intellect, all that within the limits of the lower knowledge. Now I said that, just mark this point, that the knowledge of the scriptures is regarded as lower knowledge. If you read the scriptures, if you become versed in the knowledge of the scriptures, that does not give you the knowledge of God. You can quote the Bible, you can quote the Vedas, you can quote all the scriptures, you can memorize them, you can interpret them. That will not give you the knowledge of God. You know, Shankara compares that kind of knowledge to an ass carrying a heap of sandalwood. The sandalwood has the fragrance. But the poor ass is only carrying the burden of that sandalwood, doesn't even get the fragrance. The knowledge of Brahman, knowledge of God, is something that is direct and immediate. In other words, you have to know it for yourself. Not just repeating what the scriptures, what was revealed to other saints and sages, but that revelation must come to you directly from God. So here he points out, the higher is knowledge of that by which one knows the changeless reality. By this is fully revealed to the wise that which transcends the senses, which is uncaused, which is indefinable, which has neither eyes nor ears, neither hands nor feet, which is all-pervading, subtler than the subtlest, the everlasting, the source of all. In another Upanishad, we find it has been brought out how a great scholar came to a teacher, a knower of Brahman. And then the scholar came and told him, "Sir, I have studied plenty. I am versed in so many branches of knowledge, but I have not found any peace within me." And it was then again that this teacher brought out the truth, that it is only the knowledge of God, it is only the knowledge of Brahman that can give that everlasting peace. Now, of course, this knowledge again of Brahman is the same as the knowledge of the self. To know yourself is to know Brahman, because throughout the Upanishads you find that truth brought out, that the Atman, the inner self within, is one with Brahman. It is the same truth as Christ had taught when he said that kingdom of heaven is within, God is within. He is our very soul. And this truth is brought out in the Upanishads by what is known as Mahavakyas, the great truths which are expressed in forms of dictums. For instance, you find different Mahavakyas scattered throughout the Upanishads, like Tattvam Asi, that thou art, or Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. And these are called Mahavakyas, in other words, the great truths and sacred truths which are to be understood, meditated upon, and realized. Now, of course, naturally there comes this question immediately, but what about this I that I know myself to be? Here I shall quote to you the Upanishads, and you will see the distinction, if there is any, between this lower self, or what we call the ego, and the Atman. It brings it with an analogy. Like two birds of golden plumage, inseparable companions, the individual self and the immortal self are perched on the branches of the self-same tree. The former tastes of the sweet and bitter fruits of the tree, the latter tasting of neither, calmly observes. Now you see, this life is compared to a tree. And there are two birds in the same tree within the same body. One is sitting quietly, calm, majestic in his own glory. The other, hopping from one branch to another, tasting the sweet and bitter fruits of the tree of life. In other words, enjoying the fruits of his karmas. Doing karmas, enjoying the fruits of karmas, either enjoying or suffering according to the nature of his deeds. But it is that individual self, that lower bird that is hopping from one branch to the other, is enjoying or suffering, is within the limits of the law of karma. But the higher birds of golden plumage, just observing it. The individual self, deluded by forgetfulness of his identity with the divine self, bewildered by his ego, grieves and is sad. But when he recognizes the worshipful Lord as his own true self and beholds his glory, he grieves no more. You see, we taste a bitter fruit, then we look to the upper bird, and we are attracted by the calmness, by the tranquility, by the glory of that bird, the worshipful Lord. Then again we forget. Again we go on tasting sweet and bitter fruits of the tree. Again we look upon that worshipful Lord. And we proceed nearer and nearer. Then ultimately this lower bird vanishes, becomes one with that. And then one realizes that its shadow was playing all the time. When the seer beholds the effulgent one, the Lord, the Supreme Being, then transcending both good and evil, and freed from impurities, he unites himself with him. Then he transcends the law of karma. Now in this connection again, let me point out that, of course, the Hindus believe in this law of karma and rebirth and reincarnation, as I have many times explained to you. But whenever I go to read the writings of any of the Westerners, and they talk about this karma and reincarnation, in the first place they point out that karma is fatalism. And so the people of India are fatalists. That's why they are suffering from poverty. But karma means free doer. What I have made myself, I do not blame God for that. You see, if you don't believe in karma, what is it? God created us. God sends us this. We can't do anything about it. So it is the Christian theology that makes people determinists, that is, fate. This will happen, we can't help. But fortunately, the Western world does not take Christianity seriously. Now this karma means free doer. What I am, I have made myself by my own doing. I can unmake. So there is that will, effort, which is very important in order to grow in any department of life. And that's what law of karma emphasizes. Then furthermore, I read always this statement that they believe in reincarnation, so not in one life they can attain liberation. They will have to be born again and again and again. And then after many births, they will attain that liberation. Now, of course, Christians can die and immediately go to heaven. Now, of course, that again is a complete misunderstanding of the very philosophy of karma and reincarnation. You see, as you read in the Upanishads, you will find that these sages do not believe in post-mortem heaven or liberation. They believe in liberation while living. To quote the words of the Upanishads, ihoiva na sharira patat uttarakalam. You have to attain that liberation here and now, not after the death of the body. In other words, you have to free yourself from this reincarnation and rebirth in this very life and existence. As long as you are born as a human being, you have the right and you have the capacity, if only you make an effort, to attain God and attain that liberation this very moment of your life. That is what has been emphasized in all the teachings and philosophies of India. Now to come to our point. What is that? What is Brahman? Tattvam asi, that thou art. What is that? In other words, what is God? In one of the Upanishads we read, a disciple comes to the teacher and he asks to know of Brahman. There was no answer. The teacher was silent. Then the disciple again asked, "Sir, please answer me. I've come to learn of Brahman. Teach me." Still there was silence. Third time the disciple asked, and this time the teacher said, "I have been teaching you. His name is silence." In other words, that the truth of Brahman cannot be expressed in words, cannot be defined. To define is to limit. Now again here we find how they say that these Hindus have no definite conception of God, definite idea of God. And we have the definite conception, definite idea. Here is my God, come and worship. But that is the idolatry, you see. To define God is idolatry. You cannot define that which is indefinable, inexpressible. To define is to limit. You can describe a finite thing. How? In comparison to something else or similar to something else. You can define. But is there any comparison to God? Is there anything similar to God? Now again the question arises. But how are we to approach it? Here you find in India many gods and goddesses. In fact, we say, if there are 33 million people, there should be 33 million gods and goddesses. Because each one of us must try to approach the truth of God in our own way. And what is that truth? That absolute truth? You are reading with your mind that absolute truth. And your reading is true. Another's reading is true. So there are many aspects of Godhead. Now you read any Western book On Hinduism, he will find that how they worship many gods than the goddesses. You get tired of reading these ignorant writers, you know. And they come to this country with pictures and would show them how they are worshipping different gods and goddesses. Now to come to the subject of the Upanishads. I just read a book, you know, and that... Well, I'll spill out something more. You know, this professor who had been to India, and this book is going to be very popular, it seems. And he found out that there are rival groups, rival religions in India. And with this awakening of national consciousness, there is an awakening of their indigent religions of the country. And as such, Christianity does not only have to fight communism, but Christianity will have to fight these rival religions that exist in India. Because Christianity means that is the only way to salvation. That is the very fundamental principle and truth of Christianity. And if that is so, I would make this remark, the sooner it dies, the better for the world. I don't mean Christianity. I mean such ideas. But Christianity will live. You see, as Toynbee pointed out, that at one period they thought that Christianity and Muslim or Mohammedanism could not exist. So, and both of these followers thought that way, that either Mohammedanism must come out and kill Christianity, or Christianity must come out murdering the Mohammedans. But you know, though they tried to murder one another, we find that they are still alive and they are coexisting and living side by side. Now, what is this Brahman? That is that inexpressible, indefinable. The highest expression that we find in the Upanishads or any description that is given is Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means that is the absolute existence, the ground of all existence. Chit means the pure consciousness, the ground of all consciousness. In other words, you exist, I exist, this universe exists because of that existence. And that is Chit, pure consciousness. There is the expression of life and consciousness everywhere, even in rocks and stones. Because of that Brahman as the ground of all existence and of all consciousness. Also, that is Ananda. Ananda means two, love and joy. They are identical. And there is that expression of joy and love because God, Brahman, is the ground of all that. Now again, where is that Brahman? You see, when we speak of Brahman, it's all pervasiveness. Now where is that Brahman? That is the Atman again, the self within. Now we find a psychological definition of that. And trying to explain the psychology of this Atman, these great seers point out that this Atman is encased in sheaths, and five sheaths. One sheath is made up of food. That is this physical body. Then another sheath made up of vital energy. Then another sheath is made up of manas. You see, I'm not translating the word manas into mind, because the Western word mind and manas are not the same thing. Manas is only that part of the mind which accepts what is brought through the doors of the senses. Then manas gives it to buddhi or intellect, we call. So there is this sheath of intellect. The intellect discriminates, classifies, distinguishes the object. And then another sheath called ego. Then the buddhi again gives it to that sense of ego. And then I recognize the object as such and such. So these are the five sheaths. Physical, this body, the vital breath, the manas, the buddhi, and aham. These are the five sheaths. And if we transcend these sheaths and take the reality, we shall find the Atman. And the Atman is encased in these sheaths, remains hidden. And because that remains hidden, there is an identification. And through that identification, there has arisen that sense of ego. Now, as long as we are within the limits of, you know, then the Upanishads point out about the states of consciousness. The sleeping, dreaming, and wakeful. These are the three states of consciousness that we know of. And within these three states of consciousness, we are identified with the one or all of these seeds. And as such, the Atman or God within remains unknown. This is the whole psychology of the Upanishads. When we are awake, we are identifying with all the seeds, with all the five seeds. When we are dreaming, then we are identifying with the seed of the mind. We are not anymore conscious of the body. When we are in deep sleep, we have still the sense of ego latent. In other words, there is the sheath of ego within us. We have got rid of the sheath of mind and body. So within these three states, there will remain that identification. Yes, intellectually you may understand. But, as I said, that intellectual understanding and the study of scriptures does not give you the knowledge of God. So you have to transcend all these sheaths and transcend these three states of consciousness and reach Turiya, or the fourth. Then you realize your Atman. You know what you are. And that self-knowledge immediately brings that unified consciousness with Brahman. Now when we come to the methods and means, there are three steps according to the Upanishads. First you have to hear of this truth, then you have to reason upon this truth, then you have to meditate upon this truth, the truth of the identity of Atman and Brahman. What is my true nature? My true nature is divine. This we have to hear from a teacher. Then we have to reason upon that. Not accept, but reason. What is that Atman? What is that Atman that is one with Brahman? That's how there were different systems of philosophy that evolved in India. To help to reason. Then, as you become convinced, then meditate upon that. Now again, you know, the religion of the Upanishads is not so very the practice is not so very simple and easy. It's a long, strenuous, arduous discipline. In the first place, this knowledge also is known as secret knowledge and is not imparted to everybody, because everybody is not ready for it. In order that we can be ready, we have to undergo certain preparations. You will find in the Kathopanishad, when this boy Nachiketa came to the king of death, the great illumined teacher, and his enquiry was the secret of death, or secret of immortality. Then this great teacher tried to tempt him. Look, don't ask that. You ask for anything else. Enjoyment. Eternal youth. Eternal youth again also, of course, not eternal in the sense of eternity. But a long life, when you can enjoy, and I'll give you damsels and chariots and aeroplanes and Cadillac cars and anything you want. But don't ask me of this secret. But this young boy, Nachiketa, he had discrimination in his heart. And he said, but supposing I take all that, how long can I enjoy? I will have to face you sometime. The longest life compared to eternity is short. So I want that bliss, that enjoyment, which is the enjoyment for eternity. And then he said, you keep your damsels and cars for your own enjoyment, my teacher. I want that knowledge. So that is the preparation. If you seek for anything, whatever you seek for, you get. But you need discrimination. What is the highest good? You see, that's why this great teacher teaches Nachiketa. There are two things. There is good and there is pleasant. Now, I didn't mark that passage, but I'll find out for you. It's beautiful. The good is one thing, the pleasant is another. These two, differing in their ends, both prompt to action. Blessed are they that choose the good. They that choose the pleasant miss the goal. Both the good and the pleasant present themselves to men. The wise, having examined both, distinguish the one from the other. The wise prefer the good to the pleasant. The foolish, driven by fleshly desires, prefer the pleasant to the good. Thou, O Nachiketa, having looked upon fleshly desires, delightful to the senses, hast renounced them all. Thou hast turned from the miry way wherein many a man wallows. Far from each other and leading to different ends are ignorance and knowledge. Thee, O Nachiketa, I regard as one who aspires after knowledge, for a multitude of pleasant objects were unable to tempt thee. You see, it tested his disciple before he began to impart that knowledge. So in short, I will tell you these disciplines. First is discrimination between the eternal and non-eternal. What is the highest good? Then you come to this understanding that God alone is real. You see, this is not anything new. You go to any religion, unless it is distorted, always there is that discrimination for the eternal. Seek not for the treasures that will be eaten by moth. I can't quote exactly. I don't have the Bible and I didn't consult it. But if you read that, you will find that how Christ admonishes us to seek only for that which is eternal. Then, as you come to that discrimination, that is not enough. You must learn to desire for the eternal and try not to desire for the enjoyments of the world. You see, that will take you. You may discriminate, but you will fall away. So, you have to keep that consciousness awake in you and seek not for the enjoyment of the fruits of your action. That's what it says. The fruits of your action. In other words, you have to learn to act, to work and live in this world, and every action to be dedicated to God. Not seeking for the fruits of action, seeking for the enjoyment of the fruits of action to come to you. And here is another point. To renounce the fruits of action here as well as hereafter. That is, we have the idea of heaven. If you do good deeds, you will go to heaven and enjoy heaven. But our idea of heaven is this: you can go there and enjoy, but again you are born there, you will have to die there and you come back. So seek not for that. That is the lower goal. Then you have to acquire 6 treasures in your life. First treasure is tranquility. Shama. Now, what is this shama or tranquility? You see, it comes as we detach our mind from the objects of the world and direct the mind towards God. Tranquility is not something superficial, something that is external. But the tranquility that comes from our absorption in God. Then dhamma is self-control, which means that do not let your mind react to external stimuli. Then titiksha, forbearance. Things come, pleasure comes, suffering comes, but you have to bear without lament, but bear patiently. It will pass. Then uparati, poise in the midst of the opposites of life, holding on to the pillar of God. Shraddha, faith. Faith in the words of the teacher and in the words of the scriptures. In other words, you have to have that faith that this knowledge is the supreme knowledge and it can be had. I can have that truth. You see, that faith, as I said many times, everybody needs to have in order to gain any kind of knowledge. You go to a physicist. Why would you go to a physicist if you have no faith in that knowledge? And why would you do anything to acquire that knowledge if you have no faith in that knowledge? So that faith is necessary. Then, samadhan, or self-surrender. Surrendering ourselves. Surrendering the fruits of our actions to God. These are the 6 treasures we have to acquire in life. Then, of course, lastly, what is called mumukshutva, the desire for liberation. You see, if you just think, oh, there are so many reincarnations, I can be born another life and I will have that knowledge, I will acquire that knowledge. But for the present, let me enjoy, and then I have so many desires. In the next life, I will satisfy those desires. And then some other life I shall attain to liberation. Now that, Buddha calls that sin. If there is any sin, it is that laziness. So there is that urge, you must struggle to find that in this life and be through with reincarnation. Now, you see, there are those three steps. You hear, then you reason, and then you meditate. And through meditation, of course, you go beyond one sheath after another. You know, for instance, as your mind becomes concentrated, you forget your body. You will lose the consciousness of your body. But still, you see, there are distractions in the subconscious region of the mind. You overcome those distractions, be completely absorbed. Then you come to what is called the karana sharir, the causal sheath. There you have the awareness of Brahman or God as creator, from whom comes this whole universe. Then again you go beyond that and you see and realize the impersonal, the absolute reality. And there you realize your identity with Brahman. Atman and Brahman are one. Now again in the teachings of the Upanishads, this truth of the identity of Atman and Brahman assumes two distinct forms, following two different trends of thought. One is called nisprapancha, acosmic. Another is called saprapancha, cosmic. And we find both these in the teachings of the Upanishads. You see, what is acosmic? That is, this universe is not real. It has no reality, it has no existence. Brahman alone is real. There is just one, not many. This many is an illusion in a way. And we find passages to support this idea. I'll read out to you from the teachings of Jagavalkya to his wife Maitreyi. You see, after when he thought about that there is just one and the ego is gone, is lost, and you are one with Brahman. So Maitreyi, the wife, you know, as she listened to that truth, she said, where there is consciousness of the self, individuality is no more. This that you say, my Lord, confuses me. Then Jagavalkya replies, my beloved, let nothing I have said confuse you, but meditate well the truth that I have spoken. As long as there is duality, one sees the other, one hears the other, one smells the other, one speaks to the other, one thinks of the other, one knows the other. But when for the illumined soul the all is dissolved in the self, who is there to be seen by whom? Who is there to be smelt by whom? Who is there to be heard by whom? Who is there to be spoken to by whom? Who is there to be thought of by whom? Who is there to be known by whom? Ah, Maitreyi, my beloved, the intelligence which reveals all, by what shall it be revealed? By whom shall the knower be known? The self is described as not this, not that. It is incomprehensible, for it cannot be comprehended. Undecaying, for it never decays. unattached, for it never attaches itself, unbound, for it is never bound. By whom, O my beloved, shall the knower be known? This it is that I teach you, O Maitreyi. This is the truth of immortality. Also, I'll read out to you another passage from the Mundaka Upanishad. As rivers flow into the sea, and in so doing lose name and form, even so the wise man, freed from name and form, attains the Supreme Being, the Self-Luminous, the Infinite. There are many other passages to that effect. And basing his philosophy upon these passages, the great seer philosopher Shankara propounded his doctrine of what he calls vibhortabad, or superimposition, which means that the universe has no reality. Oh, Brahman alone is real. This universe is a superimposition upon Brahman. And that famous illustration, the rope and the snake. There is the rope. And it is not that the rope has become transformed into the snake when you see the snake, but you are superimposing the snake on the rope. This is his doctrine, of course. It needs much elucidation, but I won't go into that. Then again we find there are other passages in the Upanishads which bring out this truth that whatever you see, perceive, everything is Brahman. All is Brahman. And here in the same Upanishad we find, you see this truth. I'll just read out to you a few passages. This earth is honey for all beings, and all beings are honey for this earth. The intelligent immortal being, the soul of this earth, and the intelligent immortal being, the soul in the individual being, each is honey to the other. Brahman is the soul in each. He indeed is the self in all. He is all. You see, not only the Atman is Brahman, but this cosmos is identified with Brahman. I'll read out to you some other beautiful passages from the Upanishads regarding that. O Brahman Supreme, thou art the fire, thou art the sun, thou art the air, thou art the moon, thou art the starry firmament, thou art Brahman Supreme, thou art the waters, thou the creator of all. Thou art woman, thou art man, thou art the youth, thou art the maiden, thou art the old man tottering with his staff, thou facest everywhere. Thou art the dark butterfly, thou art the green parrot with red eyes, thou art the thundercloud, the seasons, the seas. Without beginning art thou, beyond time, beyond space. Thou art he from whom sprang the three worlds. So you see, both these cosmic and acosmic ideas are to be found in the Upanishads. And Shankara based his philosophy upon the passages that are acosmic. And then again we find another philosopher, Ramanuja. He based his doctrine upon these passages which are cosmic. And his philosophy is called the philosophy of transformation, Parinambad. Brahman has become transformed as this universe. Now the point is, which of these doctrines are really supported by the Upanishads? You see, of course, I bow down to Shankara and I bow down to Ramanuja, but I beg to differ from both of them. Because this I'm just giving my own opinion. Just take it or leave it. because there are Shankarites and followers of Ramanuja, and each one will claim that his doctrine is supported by the Upanishads, not the others. But this is my humble opinion, that the Upanishads set no particular doctrine. It is not philosophy in that sense. It supports no doctrine. But you can get any doctrine out of them. So I would not say that now they are both were mistaken completely. But I'd say they got only a partial view in trying to make a philosophy out of mystic revelations. The same sun sages of the Upanishads, they were satisfied just by giving utterances to what they experienced. And in the process of mystic experience, you have all these experiences. The universe becomes annihilated. Time, space and causation cease to exist in what we call the Nirvikalpa-bhumi. Then the universe disappears, just one absolute existence. So there is the truth, that this world appearance is an appearance, not a reality. Now again, having attained that, the illumined soul can live in two states. One is normal state, another is between the normal and that supernormal state, what Sri Ramakrishna used to call bhava-mukha. Now, while in the normal state, he sees this universe, the appearance is there. But he knows, he has the revelation. He knows that this is only an appearance. Reality is Brahman. So he considers this appearance as a superimposition upon Brahman. He doesn't see Brahman at that time, but he has the memory. And also he has the memory that this is only an appearance. It has no reality. And so, what he says, that this universe is not real, it's a superimposition upon Brahman. The reality is Brahman. Now again, the illumined soul can live in the state between that and this. Then he sees this whole appearance, world appearance. But behind this world appearance, he also sees Brahman vibrating everywhere. You find as Sri Ramakrishna suddenly, while he was doing the worship, he suddenly saw the image was Brahman, the bricks which made up that building, the vessels and utensils and his body and everything shining, blissful mother, shining everywhere. So you see, these are two mystic experiences from different standpoints. And if we try to take the one and refuse to take the other or try to twist them to suit our doctrine, that will be making a mistake. So you see, there is harmony between these two mystic experiences. There is no discord. But we shall get into discord if we try to make a doctrine out of these mystic visions and experiences. So again, the whole message of the Upanishads is this, that religion is not in doctrines, not in just beliefs, not in intellectual understanding, but to experience the truth of God within one's own heart. Om Hari Om, Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrittorma Amritangamaya, Abir Abir Maiti, Rudrajate Dakshinang Mukham, Tate Mang Pahinityam. Om. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from death to immortality. Lead us from darkness to light. Light us through and through, and guide us evermore with thy loving presence. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Peace.